Thank you everyone for joining this morning for our June partnership webinar, Capturing Your Ace of Spades. So I want to go ahead and hand the presentation over to Justin Hoffman, Executive Vice President of PSA.
I'm really happy to be sharing our morning together with Eric, as well as everyone who's dialed in. I certainly miss seeing everyone in person at PSA, but we are really excited for today's program, and we will, I'm sure, see you all soon. So for anyone on the call who doesn't know PSA, we are an independent insurance broker who works with organizations, so that's businesses, nonprofits, educational institutions, to build high-performing and progressive modern group benefits plans and human resources operations. We also work with organizations to build safer, better protected workplaces with commercial insurance programs with a special focus on cyber liability. And we help individuals with insurance plans you need to protect your property, your families, and your personal assets. We do appreciate everybody who dialed in today. We know you're busy. We had over 407 people register for the webinar today. So that's something that we feel really proud of and certainly speaks to the interest that everyone has in Eric's message. And now I'm really excited to welcome Eric Maddox. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. In 2003, Eric collected the intelligence that led to the exact location of President Saddam Hussein, the Ace of Spades in the infamous deck of cards issued by the US military that had the 52 highest value targets in the Iraq war. His technique has shaped the future of intelligence gathering and collection for the military as well as civilians across the globe. Today, he shares that technique, empathy-based listening, with organizations spanning the world as an inspirational speaker, an author, a consultant, and a negotiator. Empathy-based listening really teaches us that trust is the most important element in all relationships. When you have the highest levels of trust, you'll find new heights in your influence. You turn your customers into advocates. You turn your employees into champions. And you're able to solve the hardest problems that you face. It's not an exaggeration to say the higher the trust level in all of your relationships, the better all aspects of your life will be. And I think if you think about that, that is a true statement. Eric is here today to share his extraordinary story and show us how we can put his system to use within our lives as we pursue our own Ace of Spades. Eric is a high octane guy. He didn't want to spend a lot of time on introductions. He wanted us to just get right to it. And so that's what I'm going to do right now. So Eric, you know, thank you again for being here with us today. I think the backstory that led us up to the point where you found yourself in Iraq is a really interesting one. I know when I first heard about you and what you had done, and maybe I watched too many movies and TV shows, but I kind of had a mental image of probably how it went down. And I expected to learn that you had decades and decades of experience doing just what you were asked to do, extensive training, war rooms full of intel, dossiers on every single person that you were pursuing, and many years on the field of combat. But as it turns out, that really wasn't the case, was it?
No, Justin, that would have been great, but it just wasn't the case. When the United States military invaded Iraq in 2003, I was in the Army, but my focus was Chinese, Mandarin, linguist. They'd trained me as an interrogator, but I'd never done interrogation my entire life. They had also taught me Chinese Mandarin, and I'm used as an intelligence collection officer against the Chinese. And I was told I'll never, ever be sent to Iraq. So obviously, I was very shocked when 3 months into the war, I'm stationed in Los Angeles, California. I'm responsible for doing all these interviews of Chinese citizens who illegally enter the United States through our ports. And my commander hands me these highly unexpected top secret orders to Baghdad. And he also tells me, he said, Eric, they're just for you. We have no idea what unit it is. And you're supposed to leave in 10 days. So Justin, I packed my bags. I didn't know who I was going to be joining. I showed up to the Baghdad International Airport and I am picked up by this team of soldiers. They all have civilian clothes, full beards. They took me in this really secluded building and they basically say, we are the Joint Special Operations Command. We're responsible for tracking down everyone on the deck of cards. We're going after Saddam Hussein. And I'm like, that is so cool. I didn't know if groups like you actually existed in the military. And now I know that you do. And that's great. Why on earth are you telling me this? Because I'm a Chinese Mandarin linguist. And they said, Eric, we have a team of interrogators that are, you know, responsible for interrogating the prisoners that we bring off the battlefield. He said, but we have Delta Force teams out there out in the Badlands. And one of the Delta Force teams wants an interrogator to go out there with them on the missions, on the raids. And they said, well, it's not what interrogators do. So we called the Army and said, listen, give us a list of every single interrogator who's former infantry and a graduate of the Army's Ranger School. They said, Eric, you were the only name on the list. So, Justin, when I first joined the Army, I was an enlisted grunt, spent 3 years as a paratrooper at the 82nd Airborne Division. While I was there, I graduated from the Army's Ranger School. And so I'm pulled into this task force, and they said, by the way, we're sending you out with this Delta Force team, and prisoners aren't talking. We don't know why. Techniques don't work. So welcome to your first battlefield. So yeah, I would have loved to have that great experience you were talking about, but that's the setting for my first deployment on this mission to Iraq.
Wow. Feels like a quite a monumental task you are presented with. All right. So here you are being asked to somehow crack the code where no one else has had success. Can you tell us a little bit about your first attempts at interrogations, how they went, what you learned along the way, how you were forced to form a plan on the fly and be adaptable, and of course, how you were able to get the critical intel that led to the capture of the world's most infamous high-value target?
Yes. So I was immediately sent to Tikrit, Iraq. That's Saddam's hometown. It was Saddam Hussein out to Tikrit. I joined this Delta Force team, and they very clearly said, we have no idea who the enemy are. We've not fought a war like this before. There's no uniforms. There's no military government of Saddam's regime. It's this insurgency of individuals who, you know, during the day, they may have jobs, they wear civilian clothes, and at night, they're blowing up our troops, and we don't know who they are. And the United States military has a prison full of hundreds of detainees, and they're not talking. So go get the information. The next day after I got there, I brought a couple of prisoners. I lived in the Delta Force house with them. They had a room for me. They had a linguist. I began these interrogations, Justin, and I was trained as an interrogator. Although I'd never done it before, you know, in a real combat, I had been trained by the techniques. The problem is the military techniques were built for a war. And the idea was that you're going to get the soldier off the battlefield and you're going to convince them that they can't talk out of their lies, and there's no way that they're going to be able to escape or go home, and they're essentially going to go, uncle, here's everything I know. Justin, quickly, I realized those techniques are not going to work. And I didn't know how to get these prisoners to open up. But I told myself, you've got to figure out who they are. I don't want to know what it means to be Iraqi. I don't know what it means to be an insurgent, to live under the wrath of Saddam. And so very quickly, I said, Eric, just talk to these individuals. Just figure out who they are. And as I did that, I started to realize, if you don't accuse them of being the bad guy and you just ask them questions, they will answer your questions, but sometimes they're more open and sometimes they're closed down. And I started to realize when they're most transparent, it was about me and the way that I was listening to them and the way that I wasn't judging them based on my preconceived notions, or I wasn't trying to fulfill my agenda of trying to get them to confess and provide direct intelligence immediately. It was me just listening to their situation, and I can really start to get them to at least be transparent about who they were. And I started to realize the more that I do this, I was able to build this trust with these individuals I'd never met before, most likely wanted to kill me a couple of days before this, and they started to open up and reveal information about the insurgency in the Sunni Triangle. As we did this, my Delta Force commander, his name is Bam Bam. Bam Bam told me, he said, "Herrick, we're starting to get information. I think you can get us targets." And the more I communicated and connected with these prisoners, they started to give us actual targets of insurgent members. And the more that we could bring back individuals who had this information, I was able to connect with them. And eventually they really started to open up the insurgency. And over the next 5 months, I went through 300 interrogations in Saddam's hometown. And we created a link diagram with over 2,500 names on it. And we finally, after 5 months, we finally realized the very top of this insurgency was one man. He was a former inner circle bodyguard of Saddam Hussein. And this guy was running the entire show. And as my tour is running out, my Delta Force commander, he came to me and he said, "Herrick, we're running out of time. They're going to send you back. We've never done interrogations to lead missions, to lead kind of the entire direction of a unit." He said, "When you lead, this thing's going to get shut down. We've got to get to the top." And I said, "We've got to find this bodyguard." And he said, "Give us every single target." He goes, "Literally, you're leaving this town in 5 days. And at that point, we hit every friend, every relative of this bodyguard. His name is Muhammad Ibrahim. And with 4 days left in my mission, we captured the driver of this bodyguard. And the driver of the bodyguard, he and I connected. And he told me, he said, "Herrick, I deliver every single order for every attack that's occurred in the Sunni Triangle since this war began." He goes, "And I deliver millions and millions of dollars every single week. I take all orders and all money from the bodyguard, Muhammad Ibrahim." And the driver looks at me and he said, "He's taking all orders from Saddam." And I said, "Where is Saddam Hussein?" And the driver of the bodyguard looks at me and he said, "Herrick, I don't actually know." He said, "He's got to be in Tikrit." He said, "Muhammad Ibrahim is in Tikrit." And the driver said, "Muhammad Ibrahim's actually the only person that knows where Saddam is." And I told the driver, I said, "I'm going to get you out of here. You're not going to spend the rest of your life in this prison." He said, "I've got to have the bodyguard." And the driver looks at me and he said, "Okay." He said, "Every single night, I drop that bodyguard, Muhammad Ibrahim, off of one of 5 safe houses in Tikrit. He will be at one of those safe houses tonight." And he gave me all the locations. And I went to Bam Bam and I said, "We're going after Saddam Hussein." And Bam Bam said, "Herrick, we love you, man. This whole thing's been great. And you've really give us some targets, and who'd have thought we were going to give it from prisoners? That just wasn't the way we'd been doing things. Nobody thinks Saddam Hussein's in Tikrit." And I said, "Bam Bam, I've connected with these prisoners. We've built a bond. They are working with us, for us, and they know we're looking out for them. He's here." He said, "If Saddam's here, we're going to find him while you're here." He goes, "When you leave, this thing, they will not push this anymore." And I told him about the safe houses and the driver. And he said, "All right, tonight we're hitting all 5 of those safe houses of the bodyguard." And that night, the Delta Force team, they hit all 5 locations. And the bodyguard wasn't at any of them. And they brought me back all the prisoners. And Bam Bam said, "You know, Herrick, we got 2 days. And what used to take me hours, I could get these individuals to open up. I could connect with them. And within minutes, people at the houses, they were saying, 'Yeah, Herrick, we were running a safe house for Muhammad Ibrahim, the bodyguard.'" And another prisoner said, "Herrick, you guys scared him out. You put pressure on him. You scared him out of town. He's gone to this town of Samarra." And they gave me the location. He said, "He's got a sub commander that runs all of Samarra. It's this man at this house." And I went to Bam Bam and I said, "Listen, those were 5 good hits. Those were his safe house. We've now pushed in this exact house. I promise he'll be there." And Bam Bam looks at me and goes, "Awesome, great, we're going to go." And we went and we raided the sub commander's house in Samarra, and Muhammad Ibrahim, the bodyguard, was not there. And Bam Bam brought me back the prisoners, and the subcommander's brother, he connected with me, and he broke, and he said, "Herrick, the bodyguard, he's never stayed at my brother's house. He's a block away from where you captured me. He just rented this house He's a block away from where you just had me. And I went to Bam Bam and I said, listen, I promise. I know he wasn't there, but here he's here at this spot. And Bam Bam says, all right, man, we got a day and a half. This has got to work. And we went and we raided the rental house. The bodyguard knew, I knew he was going to be there, and he was not there. And Bam Bam brought me back to prisoners from the house. He said, you have 24 hours and we're leaving. You're going, you're flying back to Baghdad and then you're going to leave the country. And he brought me back to prisoners. And one of the prisoners was the bodyguard's 20-year-old son. And the son, he looks at me and he said, Eric, my dad, Muhammad Ibrahim, he was here 2 hours before you came. He left. How am I supposed to know where he is? I looked at all these prisoners I had, all the ones that were fully cooperative. And I said, how's any of them supposed to know where my bodyguard went now? And I told myself, you sit with this boy and you connect with him. You listen to him. And I set him down. And I was talking to Muhammad Ibrahim's son, and we connected. Justin, we like really connected, because it went from more of an interrogation to what I would describe as more like a counseling session. Mm-hmm. Because Muhammad Ibrahim's son and his dad had kind of a falling out, and the boy starts crying, and he says, you know, my dad doesn't respect me anymore. He didn't think of me as a man. And he said, I wish my dad and I, we could do things like we did when I was a kid. And I said, well, what'd you guys used to do as a kid? He goes, well, we used to go fishing. He said, it didn't take me fishing anymore. I said, you know, your dad's kind of caught up in a war right now. You might want to cut him some slack. And he said, no, my dad still goes fishing. He just doesn't take me. And when he said that, I remembered one of the early interrogations I did when I got to Tikrit. Justin, we captured Saddam Hussein's cook. And the cook had cooked every meal for Saddam for 8 straight years. And the cook said, listen, Saddam Hussein, he really just likes this one dish. It's a fish dish. It's called mazgouf. And the cook said, I make the best mazgouf in the world. I'm Saddam Hussein's chef. And when the boys said they still go fishing, I said, wait, where do they go fishing? And he said, Eric, they fish along the river. And I said, where? He said, well, they just built this fish pond. They fish next to the pond. And I knew, why would you build a fish pond during the middle of a war unless you needed to stock the pond for your brutal dictator boss because you couldn't go to the market and get fish? And I went to Bam Bam and I explained him the whole story. And Bam Bam looks at me and he said, on your last night, we're going to raid a fish pond. And I said, Bam Bam, Muhammad Ibrahim's going to be there. And he said, all right, we're going to do it. He said, Eric, literally, your flight goes back to Baghdad tonight. We're going to do the raid. He's got to be there. And that night, the team, they raided this fish pond out in the along the Tigris River in the town of Samarra. And Bam Bam calls on the radio. He said, Eric, they built this shack. We're going in. And they raided the shack. And he said, we got two guys. He said, it's not Muhammad Ibrahim. It's not Saddam. He said, it's two fishermen. He said, get all the prisoners. He said, they're bringing your helicopter. I'll meet you at the helicopter pad with the two fishermen. And he brings the fishermen and all these prisoners. And I was saying goodbye to him. And he said, Eric, you take these prisoners. He goes, your flight will not leave the country for a couple of days. Don't quit. Don't quit. Get us the next target. And I got on the helicopter. I flew to Baghdad. And they tell me, okay, we're going to send all your prisoners to Abu Ghraib. And your flight leaves in 3 days. And that night, I brought those two fishermen in. And I interrogated him one at a time. And eventually, it took me 13 hours, Justin, but I finally connected with one of them. And the fisherman, he breaks. And he said, Eric, I work for Muhammad Ibrahim. My job, I catch fish in the river and I put it in the pond. He said, every few days, they come grab fish out of the pond and they leave. I asked the fisherman, I said, where did he go? Where's Muhammad Ibrahim? And the fisherman looks at me and he said, Eric, Muhammad Ibrahim, he's kind of a distant cousin of mine. He said a couple of days ago, he came and got the address of our mutual aunt and uncle in Baghdad. He said, I think you scared him out of the Sunni Triangle. I think he went to Baghdad. And I told him, I said, that's awesome. We're actually in Baghdad. And he gave me the sketch and the map. And I called the Delta commander in Baghdad. I told him, I said, listen, I'm going after this guy. And I brought him here and I need you to do the raid. And he said, I'll put it on the list. I said, what does that mean? He said, man, we do 5 raids a night. I'll put it on the list. Justin, that's all I heard. And the days came and went, and my flight is leaving the country at 8 o'clock in the morning on December 13th, 2003. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, the bam of Baghdad calls and he said, Eric, we had a slow night. We did your raid. He said, we didn't get the bodyguard. He goes, the prisoners back from the house if you want. I said, yeah, bring them back. And I'm done. They bring the prisoners back at 4 o'clock in the morning. They point to the guy that owns the house. And I said, you know, I got 4 hours. Let me see if I can connect with this man. He'll give me something. And I brought the homeowner in. I sat him down and I started talking to him. And Justin, I just listened to him. And it took me an hour. But after an hour, I realized this guy's not from Baghdad. This man's from Tikrit. Then it took me another hour and I finally dawned on me. I said, oh my goodness, this is the deputy. This is the number two guy under my huge link diagram under Muhammad Ibrahim. And at 15 minutes later, he finally breaks and he says, Eric, I'm the deputy of Muhammad Ibrahim. And I'm thinking to myself, that's awesome. I was like, I need you to take me to him and I need you to do it in about 15 minutes. And I looked at him and I said, where is he? You've got to take me to him. And the deputy looks at me and he said, Muhammad Ibrahim was sleeping next to me when your soldiers grabbed me last night. And I thought, did they get Muhammad Ibrahim last night and they didn't know it? And I went to the guards. I said, bring me any prisoner that was captured on any raids last night. And they just brought three prisoners, hoods over their heads, handcuffed behind their back. And I'm thinking, is one of these guys my bodyguard? Justin, I've never seen Muhammad Ibrahim. But I knew exactly what my bodyguard was supposed to look like. He was supposed to have a chin, like the actor John Travolta. Sure. And start lifting up hoods. And on the last hood, before I even got it off, I saw that chin. And I knew it was him. And I looked at him and I said, you're Muhammad Ibrahim. Man, I have been waiting to meet you. And he looks at me and in perfect English, he said, I've been waiting to meet you too. It's after 6 a.m. My flight leaves at 8. I had less than 2 hours. Under no circumstances were they going to let me stay because they didn't think Saddam Hussein was in Tikrit. I brought this bodyguard in and I told myself, be honest with him, connect with him. He'll give you what you need. And I did. I told him, it's just you and me. This is your shot. This was your chance. And at 7:30 in the morning, he's crying. We've connected. And he looks at me and he said, Eric, I don't know if I should do it. He didn't say he couldn't do it. He said, I don't know if I should do it. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, I think you should. I really, really do think you should. And he looks at me, he said, I can't. I can't. I said, they're going to pull me out of here. I'm getting on a plane and I'm leaving this country because nobody thinks Saddam Hussein's in Tikrit but you and me. I said, when they pull me out of here, no one's ever going to talk to you again. You're going to get put in that prison, in that cell, and you're going to die an old man because they know you're a terrorist, but they don't know what you can do. This is your shot. I need it now. And he said, I got to think. And I said, I'm leaving. And sure enough, like perfect timing, the interrogators came in. They're like, what are you still doing here? You got to go get on the plane. And I took him to his cell and I said, I'm gone. When you change your mind and you're going to take us to Saddam. I said, you've got to make them come talk to you. Go crazy. Go nuts. Do something. No one's ever going to talk to you again. And I put him in his cell and I left. And I went and grabbed my bags. And a few minutes later, they're driving me across the tarmac. I'm leaving the country. And as we're going to the airplane, the senior interrogator, he looks at me and he said, what did you do to that prisoner? I said, I didn't do anything to him. He said, well, our guards are freaking out. They think your prisoner is trying to kill himself in his cell. He said, they can't get him to stop banging his head against the wall of his cell. And I knew he broke. And I looked at the senior interrogator, I said, hold the plane. I jumped out of the truck. I ran to the prison, grabbed Muhammad Ibrahim out. I brought him to the interrogation room. I took off his hood. And I said, where is he? And he looks at me and he said, Eric, we got to go. I said, where are we going? He said, we're going back to Tikrit. I went outside. The senior interrogator, everyone's back to pick me up. And I told him, my guy broke. Saddam Hussein's in Tikrit. And he said, Eric, go get on the truck. I said, I don't think you understand. This guy broke. He said, Eric, I don't think you understand. We've been here 9 months. every single day, we do 5 raids a day looking for Saddam in Baghdad. He's never there. We don't know where he is, but we've been through every single house in Tikrit. Go get on the plane. And I gave him the sketch and the map. And I said, call Bam Bam. He's dying to take you to the Ace of Spades. And I gave him the information and I left. They put me on the truck, drove me to the plane. And when you're at this task force, you don't just go home. They take you to the headquarters, the Joint Special Operations Command in Doha, Qatar. And the next morning, I'm supposed to give this huge briefing about my link diagram. And they took me to a building and knocked on the door. And a senior officer opens up and he looks out and he said, all briefings are canceled. Clunk. And he stood there a while and a sergeant knocked on the door and he said, sir, Staff Sergeant Maddox can't leave the country until he gives this brief. And the officer looks and he said, you're Eric Maddox? I said, yes. And he pulled me inside and he said, Eric, all briefings are canceled because we got him. We got him last night. When you left, we called Bam Bam. And he said, Bam Bam, the entire Delta Force team jumped on a helicopter, flew to Baghdad, picked up Muhammad Ibrahim, took him back to the house, planned, and then executed the raid of the farmhouse of Qais Namik Jassim. They could not find Saddam. They look for an hour, and after an hour, Bam Bam goes to the truck, pulls the bodyguard out of the truck, cuts off his handcuffs, takes off his hood, and he said, where is he? Muhammad Ibrahim looks at Bam Bam in the eyes, grabs him by the hand, doesn't say a word, starts walking around the back side of the house, turns to him, stares at him, and starts kicking at the sand. And Bam Bam and the team realized he's trying to dig something up. And they started digging and they found this rope. And they continued to dig and they realized the rope was connected to a lid. And they cleared it off. And they looked at Muhammad Ibrahim, the bodyguard, and he's staring at him like, And Bam Bam and the team have their weapons drawn. They reached down and they pulled it open and they're staring at him. Saddam Hussein, the Ace of Spades. He was pinpointed by the one man he trusted to never, ever give up his location. And that man broke in less than 2 hours. So, Justin, that's how the United States military tracked down the Ace of Spades.
You know, Eric, I can't imagine what that feeling was like for you in that moment when you learned that you were successful in your mission. Obviously, it's a team and you had a lot of people there and supporting you. And Bam Bam sounds like a great partner in crime. But, you know, when you sit back and look at, like, what was the difference? They were stuck until you arrived and you worked your way through your progressions. You built your web and it was your conversations with Ibrahim that unlocked the key. And when you look back at, you know, military history and you think about how so many victories and how many successes were team-based in nature, but this shift that occurred, this monumental development that occurred, was because of you and being in the room with Ibrahim and the conversations you had and your approach that was completely different than everybody else's. How did you feel on a personal level when you got that news?
It's the first time and the only time I've ever been in a room when I found the news. I really felt like I was looking down on the scene. I was elated. And, you know, you have to accept the fact that my career had peaked at the age of 31. But I didn't think of the historical impact this team that I was with, Bam Bam, had put his neck on the line. He was a Delta Force commander. They work at the highest level with the highest level of intelligence. They typically use information from informants from the CIA. Or NSA intelligence. And he basically said, I don't trust any of that. I want the information from the prisoners. I trust the way that Eric is conducting these interrogations. For Bam Bam and that team to even come fly all the way and say, we're going to take this individual who's now at a rear prison. We're going to take him back out front with us and we're going on a raid. And by the way, we're telling you we're going to go after Saddam Hussein, even though you say he's not there. It takes so much courage. if you're a Delta Force commander, your career path is going extremely high. And everything, the humility of just looking like a complete idiot could last for years. And there's so many leaders who wouldn't step out and do that. So for me, it was just about this team. It was about this commander trusting me. And I was so grateful that I was able to put everything behind me to trust these prisoners. And I knew their lives were going to be better. I knew that this war, this situation was going to be better because we all came together. We put all our egos aside. And we said, yeah, where are you coming from? What does this look like from a mutual perspective?
Okay, so here you are. You have this experience of floating above your body. What a surreal experience that must have been for you. The next chapter of your life begins once you've had this monumental success. Can you talk to us about what developed for you or what you created after you found the Ace of Spades?
Really, things went crazy, right? You never know what's going to happen. First of all, I still wasn't allowed to go back home to Los Angeles. I was sent directly to Washington, D.C. I was taken to the Pentagon, to the office of the Secretary of Defense. Secretary of Defense at the time was Donald Rumsfeld. I briefed Secretary Rumsfeld on the entire hunt and capture of Saddam. He loved it, loved every part about it, and basically said, I don't like that we have to borrow linguists who are sort of trained as interrogators that might be, you know, Chinese Mandarin living in Los Angeles. He said, I want my own team of civilian DOD interrogators. So by the time I got back to Los Angeles, apparently over that weekend, Secretary Rumsfeld got the funding to have a 30-person civilian interrogation team who would fall under the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I was being offered the first position. Justin, I don't really know if I had a choice whether or not I took that job. I took it.
Sounds like a yes.
I got out of the military and became the first civilian interrogator on this team. And my very first mission, they said, go teach this technique. Go teach this thing. And I didn't really know what the technique was at the time. So when I explained it, they sent me all around the world, around the country. And when I explained it, they said, man, you're just being nice. I said, no, I'm not being nice at all. I'm listening to them. But my next mission is they gave me seven of these interrogators. We went back out with the Joint Special Operations Command. And I told them, I said, we're going to do interrogations my way. I haven't actually seen anyone else do an interrogation before. And when they did interrogations, the prisoners did not break, just like the prisoners didn't break when I was first in Iraq. And I'm going to give you a statistic, Justin. Since 9/11 until now, of all the thousands of interrogations that have been interrogated using the old Army techniques, prisoners only break at 4%. 4%. And when they were doing these interrogations, the prison were breaking. I said, no, watch here. And I interrogated their prisoners and they opened up. They cooperated. They broke. They said, Eric, you're being nice. I said, no, I'm listening. They said, we hear the same things you hear. And I finally realized, I said, we are hearing completely different conversations. So as a team over the next 6 months out in the battlefield with the Joint Special Operations Command, we studied this process and we realized the problem is listening. Do you know, I'm going to give you another statistic. People on average only listen to 25% of what they hear. 25%. And why is that? It comes down to the fact that our brains, we can hear five times faster than the average person can talk. So when somebody's talking to us, we get bored out of our mind because we're instinctively a little bit selfish. And what do we do with that excess capacity? We do anything else we want with it. And what we do is we fill with all these mental distractions, things that are important to us at the time. And we realize if we're going to be great listeners and really connect with these prisoners, we're going to have to identify these distractions and put them behind us. So we created the six kind of categories of distractions. Any distractions, mental distraction you have, A, it's going to lower your listening, but we can put it in any of these six categories. And it's categories 1 through 6, category 1 being the one that's least significant to reducing your listening, to category 6, the one that really prevents you from being a good listener. And category one. These are things like my clothes don't fit really well. I didn't get a good sleep last night. I ate biscuits and gravy this morning. And I'm carb crashing. Anything in your immediate presence that doesn't have to do with the person you're talking to kind of lowers your listening. Category two are personal things in your life. Right now, if you ever receive a text and you find out your child got suspended from school or something happened to a loved one, it really distracts from the person you're listening to because your priorities. Category three distractions. These are any sort of term, nomenclature, discussion about a topic that you're not familiar with. Imagine if I sat here and told you a story about tracking down Saddam and I was talking about MOSs and AIT when I was with the JSOC and all this stuff about military acronyms, your mind would get distracted towards those terms. It lowers your listening. But then here's the thing, Justin, it's categories four, five, and six that really reduce our listening. Category four, biases that you have for or against the person that you're listening to. Preconceived notions of what you believe their beliefs are, what they see something, how they feel about a situation. It doesn't stop you from hearing, but it literally filters the words that somebody says to you. And category five, this is probably the big one, especially in our professional world. Category five distraction that reduces your listening. Thinking of your agenda, your goals in the middle of the conversation. How often are we talking to a client, a prospect, a partner, and instead of actually listening to them from their perspective, we're thinking, what do they mean? What problems do I have with my services or products that I could sell to them in order to solve their problem? We think, well, that's what we do. We're problem solvers. But the problem with being a problem solver is that we stop listening to the fiber of what they're actually trying to tell us because we turn our attention to how we can serve them with a product or a service instead of actually continuing to listen to them. And then category six is the big one, Justin. Thinking about what you're going to say next in a conversation. It's kind of the catch-all, but how often are we in the middle of conversations and we start thinking, oh, I'm going to say this. Oh, it's going to sound good. Or I really want to sound smart. Hey, I'm going to talk about this book I read or this quote that I know. And it drastically reduces what we're going to say next. And we realize if we can remove these distractions and put it behind us, we can increase our listening from 25% up to 50. And that's awesome. That's fantastic. That's not going to get these prisoners who didn't trust me one bit, who an hour before we captured him wanted to kill me. Saddam Hussein's picked somebody that he trusts will never, ever, ever give up his location. Listening at 50% isn't going to do it. I've got to get your listening into the 80s and deep into the 90s. In order to do that, we do one thing. And I promise for all you listening out there, if you take anything away from this conversation, I want you to remember this. With you do identify your distractions and put them behind you and you get your listening up to 50%. The way you escalate it deep into the 80s and 90s and build that connection with listening to somebody is you do one thing. During every conversation you have for the remainder of your lives, you should always seek to understand the perspective of the individual that you're talking to with regard to that topic of conversation at this moment in time. That is what empathy is, seeking to understand. And what we realize, if we can remove our distractions and we seek to understand somebody's perspective, our listening catapults deep into the 80s and 90s, and this miraculous thing happens. We go over what we call the hurdle of trust. You know, when you're talking to somebody, just for the rest of your life, anytime you have a conversation, whether it's with your spouse, a child, your best friend, somebody that's a partner, client, somebody you just met, or if you're on a battlefield and you just kick down their front door and now you're interrogating them, regardless of the relationship, every time you sit down with someone, the person across the table subconsciously is asking themselves, at this moment in time, does this person care more about me or themselves? If you listen with empathy above 75%, they look at you and they go, you're different. You're different than the rest of the world. You're seeking to know about me. You're seeking to understand me. And you're such a rarity that I want to be with you. I want to be a partner with you. I want to go into business with you. I want to be in association with you. But most importantly, they go, you're looking out for me before yourself. I trust you. And that is the key word. Empathy-based listening is about building trust, the deepest level of trust, so we can have partnerships that we can last forever. And so many times when we talk to business leaders and we say, how important is trust? They say, it's everything. How do you build trust? Well, we have a great brand. We have decades of experience. We do what we say we're going to do. And then when we meet a prospect or a client and we say, come with us, look what I've done for everyone in the past, you're basically saying, I don't really care about you. I'm going to do what I'm saying I'm going to do, but I'm going to put you with the mix of everyone else. And when we talk about just our brand and us, and we sell them on us instead of seeking to understand them, to identify their needs and address their needs ahead of our own, I like to look at it like this. Imagine you, your company, your brand, it's a ship, it's a boat going down a body of water. And your brand, your years of success, what you've built, you have a wake of success. And when you convince someone to trust you with telling them of your past and other accomplishments, you're simply saying, look at my wake of success. I'm going to tether you to the back of our boat, and I'm going to drag you along, and hopefully you're going to get the fumes and the crumbs of this success. We love the boat. We love the power of the boat. But when you sit with those same individuals and you seek to understand them, to identify their problems from their perspective, you basically look at them and say, I'm putting you in the boat. I'm not tethering you to the back. I'm putting you up front, and I'm putting you up front with me. And that is where everyone wants to be. And that is a different level of trust. Over the next 10 years, I did 2,700 interrogations. I've done a total of 8 deployments. I've interrogated prisoners from 25 different countries. I retired in 2014, and I went on to take this thing, to learn it and study it and figure out how do we spread it through corporations with leaders so that we can create a culture that says the foundation of what we do is we build trust, because everything we're about is seeking to understand and identify the needs of our clients ahead of ourselves. And that foundation of a partnership almost can't be broken.
You know, Eric, as you're speaking, everything you say intuitively makes all the sense in the world. And as you're speaking, I'm reflecting back on some of the relationships that I have with business partners, with coworkers, with colleagues. And without a doubt, what you're saying matches those people. That was my experience of feeling that I was in the boat with them and they were putting me before themselves. And those are the kind of people you never forget. To help our audience, you know, PSA Partnership is really all about not only the entertainment and the excitement of a great story and how you feel charged up from things like that, but also about, of course, learning a new skill that you can pick up and put to work within your organization to make your organization better, to help your people, to help your clients, and your 6 categories of distraction, perfect for that. Would you be able to take a moment and because I know over time you've transitioned to working with businesses, could you give us a little case study without revealing too much detail about how a individual or a company was able to create a major big breakthrough using your system?
Sure. I have a client. They're up in Iowa. They're a wealth manager. They had some clients that maybe had 4, 5, 10 $1 million. Their book of work was somewhat substantial. They were in their mid-40s. We began to work together about empathy-based listening. And he said, I'm going after a whale. He built the relationship and he straight up, he said, there's no reason this individual is going to go with me. They're going with the big firms, the big groups. And he said, Eric, you know, it took 3 months of building a relationship. He goes, but the key is through empathy-based listening, I never made the conversation about me. I never made the conversation about going to solution before I went to discovery. And that's a key point, Justin, that, you know, we'll get deeper into that. But the part about empathy-based listening is seeking to understand. So nobody really expects you to know exactly what they're going through, but they love it and they cherish it when they realize you are seeking to understand. He said, Eric, I always went to discovery before we went to solution. And after 3 months, he goes, I just landed the biggest client I've ever had. It's $80 million. And I was like, where does that stand? He goes, that increases me by about 150%. One client, $80 million. And he typically would have gone to, here's what we do, look at us. And he said, I can't compete with that. And I always tell people, probably if you're in a great industry, there's got to be competition. And the competitions will be fierce. And when it levels out, that lowers your value, which means your fees are going down. The best and most distinct way to differentiate yourself is to be an empathy-based listener. They cannot compete with that. There's not enough money. There's not enough brand. There's not a big enough of a boat. Because as much as somebody loves the ginormous cruise liner, if you're tethered to the back, you're still getting dragged through the water. They'd rather be inside on the captain's seat of the tugboat.
What an awesome story and illustration for privately held local companies who slug it out with these national, publicly held, international type businesses. And especially during these tougher economic times, that's a message that I think a lot of people on our call today really needed to hear, to see how it's all within their power, and someone will always take being side by side with the captain of a smaller boat rather than dragged along behind the wake of the cruise liner, as you say. We as a society are in a challenging time, a time of frustration, stress, anger. A lot is going on. The George Floyd killing has torn open a lot of old wounds, very painful. The protests and dialogue that have come have opened up new conversations and brought awareness to problems that have festered in society without sufficient visibility. All of us are impacted by these events in one way or another, but in so many different ways, depending on your race, your age, your personal experience, your family's experience. But no matter your personal journey, I think we could all agree that listening, empathy, and trust are of paramount importance right now, no matter who you are as an individual. And so, Eric, I know we've talked a little bit about the people that we've built in this PSA partnership community, the kinds of people that have been coming and meeting with us and hearing from wonderful people like yourself for 11 years now. These are brave people. These people are inquisitive. They are people that are compassionate. They want to be a part of positive change in the world. They are lifelong learners. That is who comes to these meetings and who's dialed in for this webinar. I'm certain that those people are wanting to put those talents and those proclivities to work to be a positive voice in their community, in their workplace, in their family, in all aspects of society. How would you suggest we use your powerful system to have authentic, honest, and sometimes challenging conversations about race, bias, inequity, all the things that need to be talked about but can be really hard?
So that's such a great question, Justin. It's such an important question. I need us to look at when we listen with empathy, seeking to understand, we build trust. Right now, things are divisive, volatile. People have extremely strong emotions. And it's sort of, are you on this side? Are you on this side? And what I will argue, what I will challenge everyone to realize is, most importantly, what people, regardless of where they are, this side, or somewhere in the middle, they want to be heard. They want to be able to make comments and then inquire further. So I challenge you, the next time you talk to an individual and they have a take on it, right? It's pretty much everybody. And whether it's, I believe this, I believe that we should do this about police brutality. I think we should do this. I think is most dangerous is when we ask what might be a logical but contradicting question, right? If we say, we got to stop police brutality. Well, wouldn't you say that 99% of police officers are absolutely trustworthy with high integrity? That may be absolutely true, absolutely positive. And it doesn't matter what you think or what your facts are. It matters that we listen. We could say, but the individual who was running away and stole the taser, he turned back and gave lethal weapon and tried to kill. It's like, well, but didn't you realize that their lives were in danger and they have the authority to do this? It does not matter. It doesn't matter what you think. And those are what I call provocative statements. And the point is this, when somebody makes a statement, when we contradict or we question it, it doesn't make them right. It doesn't make us coward because we don't discuss it. It means we are not seeking to understand them. When somebody makes a statement, a lot of people think they're just trying to determine, are you on their side or are you on the other side? But I think most importantly, what they want to have the discussion. They want somebody to at least hear from it from every perspective. Because anyone that knows me well, they know I don't pick up sides. I don't have feelings one way or the other. Because it prevents me from better understanding. When you say, we've all gone through our journeys in life, and we're all different ages, different experiences. It's like, right. But if I'm stuck with the perspective of me, then I only get bored. I just get one journey to enjoy. I want to see what the journeys are like for everyone. Every person I talk to, I go, this is an adventure. This is a story that of a book that I have not read yet. And there's so many intriguing parts about this individual that I don't know. I don't understand. I don't have to agree with them. They could disgust me. You think that I'm sitting in front of these prisoners? I'm like, oh, wow, you've probably killed some of my buddies. And I can't imagine that we have a ton of in common. But it's not about liking. It's not about conformity. It's about seeking to understand. I've never had a conversation with anyone during this volatile time where they really got upset with me because I'm not seeking to change them and shape them. We should seek to understand them. When we do, they're drawn towards us. How many times have we watched on TV where things can be really hostile, but when some side comes and starts listening, it just diffuses. And we all go, everybody should be like that. Everyone should be like that. But if they're not, that doesn't make them wrong. It's just, we've got more to unpack. We've got more to listen to. We don't know what their backstory is. What I always tell people in interrogations, in war, there's no Darth Vader and there's no Luke Skywalker. We don't know and we can never guess what somebody's backstory is. We just seek to understand and learn about them and watch. Regardless of how much you all disagree and just may completely be polarized, we'll come together. But even people who have so much in common, often look at family members who have so much in common, so much love, mutual respect, and they blow up all the time, it's because there's a breakdown in communication, because there's a lack of listening.
Eric, thank you for taking a little time to address that question. It's an important skill that we need to have right now. We need to be better listeners and we need to seek to understand more so than we ever have before. And I imagine there's people on this call that have been thinking about how they want to manage that conversation with the help of your system. So thank you for that. Erica, this is my turn to go ahead and hand it over to you to share some of the questions that we have collected from our audience members for Eric.
Okay, so the first question we have is, when we're reaching out to a potential client for the first time, many times we're met with impatience from the potential client. How can we demonstrate empathy-based listening during that first contact to differentiate ourselves?
Okay, so the problem is we think we have to be prepared. We're going to have our canned statement, and we just kind of got to get our foot in the door because they may just get turned off. I get it. I understand that. The problem is you're coming in with an agenda and it repels people. I'm not saying like a disgusting repel, but it pushes people away. We want to be who we are. We want to tell them what we're here for. But as quickly as possible, I need you to stop talking. Ask them something pertinent to what they do and why you're there. They're probably not looking for a brand new friend they don't know at the time, and they're not dying to discuss what they did over the weekend, right? That is nerves, and we're not exactly sure what to say. You're there for a purpose. Get to the point and ask them something. But I will say this, nothing really matters to that 30 seconds of launch. All that matters is whatever comes out of their mouth. It's what I call, we must pick up the breadcrumbs, right? We've talked about what this empathy-based listening is. When we get down in the weeds, it comes down to this. Every time somebody makes a statement, there's breadcrumbs, things that they are testing whether you are or not listening to them. And if you pick up and understand those breadcrumbs and feed them back in a discovery manner, not a solution manner, they're going to look at you and go, was that an accident? This person just listened to me. They connected. Wait. And they're going to take a step towards you. They're going to drop another breadcrumb. So as much as I can say, how do we launch off into empathy-based listening? Empathy-based listening is not about launching. It's not about preparing. It's not about making an initial statement. Empathy-based listening is about listening to whatever comes out of their mouth, pick up the breadcrumb, discover back to them.
Thanks, Eric. The next question we have is, when working with an organization where there are some existing members who have been there for a while, who have a mindset of this is how it is because this is how we've done it, and you have a new group of people with new ideas, how can you use an empathy-based listening model so that both sides of, you know, the organization can understand each other and come together for common good?
That's such a great question, right? We've got groups that it's the old guard. This way we've always done it. Got a new group. It's like, hey, let's try something new. I don't think it's working as well as we think. Well, that's exactly what I was facing in Iraq. And I think it's many times what we're facing now when industries are going through so much change as they have it over the last 5 years. So we want to be the agent of change. So we look at these two groups. What we're probably going to find is there's some hostility and some frustration when these two groups try to work together. What you want to become is that agent that's always listening to seek to understand both sides, because what they're going to look for is the discovery of the mediators, the communicators, the ones that can bring the two groups together. You want to become that person. You want to differentiate yourself. Now, when you get these two people together, because they interact, we may be even at different levels. It's not defined, this group's here and this group's over here. But when you find yourself in a conversation with these two groups battling it out, if you just seek to discover both sides, they're going to come to you. They're going to rely on you. You're going to lean on you and say, Erica, come on. Can you help them understand? And right now you gain the influence. You gain the power. Now we can unify, right? So what we don't want to do is say, they're right, you're wrong, right? It just will not work. I never spent a day telling the people in the military that the old techniques did not work. I simply had to prove the difference in the new ones and let them decide. I can't make enemies while we're trying to move a different direction. We've got to use everybody as an asset.
So the next question, how do we take what you're telling us about empathy-based listening and turn it into habits that we will use on a daily basis?
Okay, we want to have daily basis habits, right? That's the thing. We want to create change. So I want to start off, Erica, I want to start off with this. I want you to ask yourselves, in your world, in your professional world, how important is trust to building partnerships with your clients? It's probably the main thing. How do we build that trust? If it takes years to build it, and a lot of people say, Eric, it takes years. Empathy-based listening is the process where we expedite that trust that takes years and even take it to the higher level. So we first have to make a commitment to it. Second thing we need to do is accept the fact that we're bad listeners, probably about 25%. That's standard. Then we have to realize, what distracts me? What are my mental strengths? What type of person am I? and say, I'm going to make a commitment that I'm not going to be selfish towards this is what I like to be, but I'm going to be an empathy-based listener and I'm going to seek to understand. But most importantly, Erica, is this. We've got to understand what a breadcrumb is and we've got to figure out how to pick it up. So what I want to do, if you don't mind, you want to run a quick, will you mind running a quick exercise with me on what a breadcrumb looks like and how does it look like to pull it back and discover it?
Of course.
Does that work?
Yep.
Okay. I'm just going to ask you a question and we're going to take a look at breadcrumbs, okay? So okay. Here goes. Erica, everything that I've been discussing today, what part of my entire presentation do you feel like is going to stick out in your mind and maybe be impactful moving forward for you?
It's kind of probably one of the most minute details you mentioned, but it is, you framed up saying, think about the person you're speaking to and their mindset in that moment. In that moment, to me, was the most important thing because they might have a lot of external factors impacting how they're feeling in that moment. External stresses you might not be thinking about. So to me, that was one of the most impactful things.
So that's intriguing because a lot of people don't pick that up. Let me ask you this, for that moment piece of, you know, identifying somebody's perspective with regard to that topic at that moment in time, do you find yourself missing maybe that element of it?
Yes.
Give me an example, if you don't mind.
All right. It's going to be personal. My husband's a firefighter. So he comes home from work. He's worked 24 hours. And I'm like, hey, how's it going? Here's the date. And I don't think about how, sometimes how he feels in that moment. He's exhausted. He's tired. He might have had a rough day. And I'm not getting the responses that I feel like I might need from him in that moment because I'm not taking into account how he's feeling in that moment.
Okay, I'm going to stop us right here. I hate to do this because we were just about to go into a pretty good empathy-based listening conversation. That could have been real, right? Like that really would have been legit. I had to just have the exercise. So I am kind of like parking like hitting the brakes. Like, what are we doing? But I asked a question. You made a response. What stuck out with you most in your mind? You made a statement. That statement had breadcrumbs. Now, those breadcrumbs should be very obvious. What were the breadcrumbs that you left out there? The breadcrumbs was the moment with regards to what it means to an empathy-based listener, not just perspective, not just talk conversation, but the moment. I have got to follow up with that. If I don't follow up with that, and the thing that's amazing, Erica, so many people don't. So many people will take that and then run with it in a different direction. And they'll say, you know, I really think when you look at perspective, a lot of people look at only one way, but I try to look at everything from every single angle, Erica. You know, when I was in Iraq, blah, 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 blah. No, for me to connect with you, for me to gain your trust and say, me, Eric, this is about you, say, wow, most people don't pick that up. Why does that mean something to you? Give me an example, please. Right? That basically says, I'm not done. I didn't want to hear from you, Erica, so I could take it and make myself look good by making a point. I'm here to discover, wait a second, what does that really mean to you? Right? That is what empathy-based listening is about. That was one breadcrumb. Erica, you pick up every single breadcrumb during a conversation, you're going to build bonds in moments, in minutes. You know, if we would have continued that conversation, you have things that are important to you about your husband, who's a firefighter. That is real. You're the spouse of a first responder, right? That comes with emotions and fears that need to be discussed. If we don't pick up those breadcrumbs, we lose that opportunity. And we're over here trying to fulfill our agenda. I don't know where you're coming with the breadcrumb. But if I'm a breadcrumb picker up with an empathy-based listening, you drive. And no, wherever we go, that's where you want to go. And that's how I determine what your portals to empathy are. And that is how you can do this every single day. Listen to me, please. I'm begging. Empathy-based listening is about changing your life forever. Because it's basically saying, I'm on this world, not just for me. I'm seeking to understand, to build trust with everyone in my world. You pick up these breadcrumbs on every single statement. It's not once a day. It's not, hey, hopefully you'll see a breadcrumb. Every time somebody makes a statement, there's a breadcrumb out there. You pick it up and don't give a solution. Don't give an opinion. Don't give a funny story or a joke. Pick it up and discover more. We can do that every single day. You do that and watch your world change.
You were mentioning 6 distractions that we need to remove from our minds, and I think you touched on some of them. Could you go over at a high level those 6 distractions?
Okay, I'm going to do you one better, okay? I will go over those at a high level because I want to be able not to be a category 3, which is like, what are those distractions? I can't listen to Eric until I have those. But just know I have a white paper on 6 categories of distractions. It's a free resource. There's no bells, there's no strings attached. I'm going to give it to you all. You give it to everybody on this line that wants it. Let's keep it real simple. From the top, immediate non-personal distraction, anything you can see, touch, feel around you that does not have to do with the person you're talking to. Category 2, personal non-biased distractions, things that are going on in your world that don't have anything to do with the person you're talking to, but they're so important and impactful that they might divert your attention, priority over the person you're listening to. Category 3, terms, nomenclature, statements, discussions about topics you are not familiar with. Do you realize if somebody uses a term that you are not familiar with in a conversation, if you're really trying to listen, your listening will drop in half, whatever percentage you're listening, because you get wrapped around the axle because we really want to know what that means. Category 4, biases, for or against the person you're talking to, preconceived notions. This is how I think they feel. This is what I believe. This comes most importantly, Erica, to what you say at this moment in time. Oh, I know this person, Jessica. Erica, think about how often that we know someone, but we don't realize an event like COVID-19. We don't realize that the situation going on with the George Floyd and the protest, that can change somebody's perspective on a situation. And what we believe we knew about them filters what the new information is. And if we don't discover that immediately, they go, you just think you know me. You don't know me anymore. In category 5, thinking about our agenda, objectives, goals. During a conversation, huge distraction, right? Especially if we're problem solvers and we sell and we give solutions because we're going, no, this is what I do. I'm doing the right thing. You know what somebody's biggest problem is? They just want to be heard. They want to be heard with empathy. They don't want to be distracted. And category 6, catch-all, thinking about what you're saying next on the conversation.
Who are the most difficult prisoners to break and why?
Okay, most difficult prisoners to break are the lowest ranking ones. I told you prisoners break at 4%. I've done 2,700 interrogations over my career of prisoners from 25 different countries. The old technique breaks prisoners at 4%. I break prisoners at 65%. 65% when I was in Iraq, the last 9 interrogations I did to track down Saddam were all breaks. So whether at 4 or 65%, that's really hard to do. Why? Because I was getting up in the chain of command. Why is that important? Because interrogation is about listening with somebody with empathy and giving them a choice to help you or not help you. And it's all based on trust. The problem is they have to make a decision. And interrogation is about getting an individual to trust you enough to make a tough decision. And only leaders can make decisions. And the higher I get up the chain of command, the easier it is to break someone. I always tell people, give me the highest ranking person, they crumble because they have something to lose. They typically are intelligent, which got them that leadership position, and they're a decision maker. If I don't have a decision maker, they'll look at me and go, boy, Eric, you really give a compelling argument. Ah, that sounds so good. I'm in no position to even make that decision. If my boss wanted me to do that, he'll tell you.
So the next question is, how do we gain trust communicating remotely when we are used to interacting face to face?
Wow, that's so important, right? We are so used to face-to-face conversations, embracing, shaking hands, having meals. Now we're talking through our computer screens. There are barriers for communication, but I also need you to remember when I was in Iraq, those prisoners did not speak English. I had to go through a translator with different cultures, different religions. Trust is not about language and it's not about physical contact. It is about trust. Familiarity can bring that trust, but regardless of the barriers that you're facing, especially these new barriers of flipping up a laptop, working out of your home, those can all be shattered within moments if you will simply listen with empathy. When somebody starts the conversation over the lap, what you don't want to do is make it about yourself, explain things about what's going on and the mess that is going on here and make it anything that is in this backdrop. We want to make it about them. connect with them, and then this beautiful thing happens. They realize you're just 2 feet away. Maybe if you're at a laptop, you're 1 foot away, and you will actually get closer. You can build stronger trust working remotely over the laptop if you will do this than you can ever imagine face to face. But we have to accept this challenge. We can't look at this and go, this is just temporary. I can't wait till we can go back to normal. Yes, hopefully we do go back to normal. To some degree, we are going to go back to normal. But we should always look at every challenge as an opportunity. Connect with your people and learn how to communicate through the screen.
How do you clear your mind to eliminate distractions when communicating?
Well, I have techniques to clear my mind of all six categories of distractions. Let's take category three. Somebody use this real quick. Somebody uses a term, a nomenclature that you're not familiar with. Just say, sorry. Eric, you said JSOC. What is JSOC? Oh, that's the Joint Special Operations Command. Sorry. All right. Anytime somebody uses a term, unless you're really concerned that everybody's supposed to know that term and you just don't want to look stupid, stop them. It does two things. Number one, it clears your plate of that mental distraction. But number two, you know what it does? It tells them, I'm so dialed in to understanding what you're doing. I don't want anything to pass me by. Whether it's a term, a phrase, just stop them. It actually gives them confirmation. You're demonstrating that you are listening to them. And that's the beautiful thing. So that's category three. I've got techniques for all six, but here's the thing. You're going to create a void in your mind if you remove your distractions. It has to be immediately and consistently filled with the seeking to understand their perspective with regards to this topic conversation at this moment in time.
This sort of maybe piggybacks on that a little bit. How do you connect your senior leadership to this approach of empathy-based listening? They are in a position of knowing and having answers, and thus they really don't see themselves as needing to understand you. How do you get them listening?
Okay, if that is the situation, then we need to help our leadership team understand listening is not about gathering more accurate information to make better decisions. This is probably the most misunderstood part of my program. When I ask people, why is it good to be a good listener? They said, well, it makes us more knowledgeable so we can make better decisions. I'm like, no, that's a secondary benefit. Listening with empathy is about gaining trust. If your leaders, they may know everything. They may have all decisions. They don't see it's necessary to listen to you. Well, then they're missing out on trust, because regardless of the relationship, the amount of time, even doing what we said we're going to do on a consistent basis, that's the boat. And people love being on a strong, sturdy, reliable boat. But if you're not listening to understand them, then they're being dragged behind the wake. And if leadership doesn't understand that, we need to give them that analogy. And we need to ask them. We don't have to ask them. We know they want trust. This is important to them. They just don't realize it. And we have to be reminded of it. Listening with empathy is not about gaining information. Listening with empathy is about understanding to build trust. It doesn't mean I have to understand to build trust. It says when I demonstrate that I'm seeking to understand someone, they trust you for that. That is all this program is about. Earning and gaining trust, because that is how we build champions and advocates, and they do all the hard work for us. They're our marketing strategy. They go, why should I go over there? You'll see. Go talk to them. That should be our entire marketing campaign.
All right, this is the last question. Can you speak to the use of body language when listening?
Oh, body language, right? Body language is everything. I can speak to it, but I'm going to give a little bit different angle. Can I speak to body language? Here's the deal. People talk about active listening. They say, you know, you got to pick up body language. If you're going to be a good active listener, you'd have an open posture and lean forward and don't cross your arms and nod. That's the fruit of good listening. If we want to be an active listener, people give all these tips of body language. What I'm saying, you become an empathy-based listener, and that fruit is going to flood out of you. People say, Eric, do you realize when you're talking to somebody and you're listening, you're nodding, I have no idea what I do. I just know when you listen with empathy, it all shines out. But I'll tell you this, don't get hung up in somebody else's body language. When you do, that in and of itself becomes a distraction. it's part of your agenda. Why are you looking at body language? Because I'm trying to figure out if they care, if I've got them hooked. I've got to listen. That becomes a distraction. You're missing their words. Listen to them, dial into their words, and you'll watch all the fruit of great listeners come out. Don't worry about their body language. You can do neurolinguistics and somebody's lying and looking to the up and the left and all this stuff. That doesn't matter. If somebody's lying to you, we've got bigger problems because they don't trust us enough to be honest.
Okay, Eric, thanks so much for being willing to take all of those questions. I'm so thrilled that we were able to make you available to our partnership audience. Thank you again for your time, for your investment. I have to say that of all the speakers that we've had over the past 11 years, no one has put forth so much effort in pre-call planning and asking questions about what our audience needs. What do you think would be most valuable to deliver to our people? I wanted to acknowledge you for that because we've talked to and worked with some extraordinary speakers over the years, and you have just shown a level of commitment to the audience that I've never seen before. So a sincere thank you for that. What an amazing story. Your system is brilliant, and what I love about it is it is straightforward, at least what you've shared with us today. It feels like we can put this into action for ourselves in professional life, in home life, and within our community, and there is a tremendous benefit for that, and that is what we are up to here with this program. So thank you for delivering on that. I've also been listening to your podcast, Creating Influence. So I would recommend to the audience that you guys, if you're podcast listeners, definitely give it a shot. I was hooked immediately. And then Eric, you have written a book?
Yes.
Okay. Mission Blacklist number one. Is that the one?
That's
it. Is that the name? Very good. And so I would imagine that our audience is going to be very interested. Where can they get that book?
You can go to my website, ericmaddox.com.
Awesome. So wanted to also put forth a sincere thank you to our audience, to have 407 people registered and dialed in to spend the morning with us. We really do appreciate the trust that you put in us to know that we're going to spend your time well. And I'm certain that Eric delivered in that promise. I'm really looking forward to seeing everyone in person again once we get back into action and things have normalized. But until that happens, until we can welcome you into PSA, please do be on the lookout for additional invitations for webinars. Our team is putting forth a tremendous amount of very high value blogs that are there to help you run your business better, there to help you make tough decisions and to guide you when it comes to your benefits programs, your commercial insurance, as well as your individual insurance products, as well as just things to do with reopening your business and all kinds of topical important information. So please continue to review what our team is working so hard to put together. And most of all, I do want to thank you for being our partner. We appreciate you. And we again thank you for your time here today. Take care.
Thank you.